This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today we'll learn that all dietary fibers are not the same with nutraceutical formulator Dr. Gordon Chang. We'll discuss the treatment of myopia with optometrist Dr. Fallon Patel. We'll find out how to eat lighter during summer with registered dietitian Shauna Lindzen. And lastly, we'll discover how to identify emotional triggers with Dr. Iran Magan. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Good news for egg lovers, eating eggs may not be bad for your heart after all. A new study from the University of South Australia has found that eggs are not the cause of high cholesterol, as once believed. Instead, it's the saturated fat in foods like bacon and sausage that's the real concern. For many years, people thought that the cholesterol in eggs raised the risk of heart disease. But this research shows that eating up to 2 eggs a day as part of a diet low in saturated fat can actually lower bad cholesterol, otherwise known as LDL. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death worldwide, including in Australia, where one person dies from it every 12 minutes. Professor John Buckley, who led the study, says it's time to stop blaming eggs and focus on the real problem, foods high in saturated fat. I'll be joined by Dr. Gordon Chang in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000-square-foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Omega Alpha's products are created by their scientific team headed by their owner, operator, and CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Dr. Chang holds a PhD in physiology and biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto. He also has 2 years postdoctoral experience in clinical biochemistry, looking at free radicals and antioxidants. He's published over 20 peer-reviewed articles and conference proceedings, and he's a frequent guest on this show. Welcome back, Gordon. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Jamie, for having me back again on the show.
So today we're going to talk about something that connects with our last two discussions. So we started at the top of the GA tract, at right in the mouth, and we ended up at the back end. But we're going to talk about something that fits into that scheme, and that is fiber. You're the expert. Where do you want to start?
Let's give a definition for fiber. And I'm going to use a very loosey-goosey definition.
Okay.
And basically, a fiber is anything is from a plant source or carbohydrate source that is non-digestible by the body. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, for example, grass is a fiber, or the contents of grass is a fiber, because we don't have the enzymes to digest grass. Cows, on the other hand, have bacteria which will digest grass so they can get food value out of it, but we don't. So for us, grass would be a fiber. For cows, it is not a fiber, all right? Mm-hmm. So there's two types of fiber, what we call the soluble fiber and insoluble fiber. Insoluble fiber is stuff that would basically be bulking agents. So it adds volume to your stool. Mm-hmm. Soluble fiber also adds bulk and volume, but it's called soluble because it's water soluble to a certain extent.
Okay.
Right? The million-dollar question everybody asks is, why do we need fiber? Do we need fiber at all? If you think about it as a food source, We're getting no energy out of it, right? We're getting no nutritive value out of it. Why would you want to have fiber? Well, the reason you need to have fiber is because you need something to propel waste out the back end, right? Everything you eat or consume, none of it is 100% digestible. So there's always waste being produced. The way the GI tract is set up, that there are built-in mechanisms that will help you get rid of the waste product. And one of the things that you need the fiber for is that as a bulking agent, it will actually help you pass a lot of that, aid in the passage of a lot of the waste products of digestion. Right.
Right. And also the waste products that our body creates too, right?
That is correct. Now, fiber serves several purposes. One is to get rid of waste product, but it also inhibits the absorption or reabsorption of certain waste products. And the way that the GI tract works is that as it's coming out, some of it can be reabsorbed. And that means some of your toxins that you're producing or waste products can be reabsorbed. So what the fiber does is that it actually can help bind to some of those toxins. It inhibits the reabsorption of some of those toxins or waste products. Now, you have probably heard, and everybody talks about fiber as being helpful for things like cancer, right? Meaning it inhibits colon cancer,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really talks about how does it do that. Everybody thinks it's a magical thing that when you take fiber, the incidence of colon cancer drops.
Yeah, but they don't understand the connection as to why. Yeah.
If you ask, what is the mechanism, right? Well, there are several mechanisms. One, it inhibits the reabsorption of waste products. It's one way of keeping the biochemical burden of waste products or toxins on your body lower. It also inhibits the absorption of toxins that you normally encounter in the environment. And one of the things of biochemically stressing the body can result in cancers, right?
Are you talking about inflammation there?
So if you inhibit the reabsorption or absorption of toxins, you also inhibit inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
Inflammation by itself can be a potential cause for things like cancer, but it's not the only thing that can cause cancer.
Of course, right? Yeah.
Secondly, also what the fiber does, because it decreases the transit time of stool, meaning that normally if you didn't take fiber, the stool sits in your body for, say, and I'll just pull a number out of the air, say 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
If you take fiber, the stool exits the body within a day. That may not sound very important, but what you don't realize is that 2 days, the longer the stool sits in the body, the more toxins can be reabsorbed.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what you're doing with fiber is lessening the toxic load on the body or the toxin load on the body. Secondly, fiber is usually associated with fruits and vegetables. So if people are getting their fiber from fruits and vegetables, they're also absorbing a lot more antioxidants. Antioxidants themselves are very important because one of the things that antioxidants do is that inhibits the actions of free radicals. And free radicals are one of the things that also cause inflammation. So if you have the antioxidants reacting with the free radicals, it also slows down free radical damage or slows down damage to the GI tract. So that's also very important.
Fibers actually sort of help you brush and clean your colon in kind of a weird way too, right?
Yeah, it does do all that. One of the other things, fiber is also, especially the soluble fiber, is also important for the maintenance of a good microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
Microbiome is the bacteria that live in your gut. Okay, you have to have a healthy microbiome. And by that, I mean you have to have bacteria in there that produces waste products that is beneficial to the body. Or you have to have at least bacteria in there which will not cause any damage to the body by the waste products that is produced. But these microbes feed on fiber. So if you give them the right type of fiber, what I call soluble fiber, the right type, it can cause them to proliferate, which is a good thing. But one of the things that we should talk about, not every fiber is the same, meaning that some fibers will absorb some toxins better, some bacteria prefer some fibers better than the other type of fiber, all right? Mm-hmm. So again, I go back to the old, my old mantra is that eat a wide variety of fibers. The fibers associated with these wide variety of fruits and vegetables allow different types of microbes to proliferate. So this is why I like variety in your diet. You can get fiber from, say, oats. You can get fiber from, say, psyllium, all right? But psyllium itself does not provide you with a lot of antioxidants.
Okay. What's the connection fiber with water? What's the role of fiber in water?
Okay, glad you asked that question. It's like anything else, the fiber absorbs water. Soluble fiber, insoluble fiber absorb and binds water. And what water does, water, because it makes the fiber swell, it adds bulking to the fiber, but more importantly, it lubricates the passage of the stool. And with lubrication, that means the stool passes easier, right? It means the peristaltic action of the gut will force the stool out a lot easier. If you don't have enough water in your diet, what basically happens is that the fiber will absorb whatever existing water is in the food, and then it dries it out, so it makes the stool very hard. When the stool gets hard, you get constipation. So for people who are drinking or eating a lot of high fiber foods, one of the key ingredients is to make sure you drink a lot of water to go with that high fiber food. It aids in the passage of the stool and the softening of the stool.
If people aren't getting enough fiber in their diet, can they supplement? And if so, how should they supplement?
Oh, you can definitely supplement. I preferably like to get stuff in my food, right? But if you don't, like when we talk about supplementation, something like oats. Oats is a very good, easy way to supplement, but it still requires preparation, right?
Yep.
There are other types of fiber. Like if you wanted to get soluble fiber, you can use things like inulin, which is very soluble fiber. You can use that. Bacteria seem to love that also. You can use things like psyllium, which has both soluble and insoluble fiber. You can have things like marshmallow root, which has soluble fiber as well as insoluble fiber. Right? There's a whole slew. Any plant material has a lot of fiber. So even like a greens product would also work well for increasing your intake of fiber. Unfortunately, fiber is one of those things you need quantity. Right. I mean, I know people like to take a pill, but one pill does not give you enough fiber to do much. You need quantity of fiber for it to be effective.
Okay, so there's something else that people can consume, whether it's through their diet or perhaps supplement with, that will also aid with some of the processes that we went over, and that's probiotics. So How do probiotics work with the gut microbiome?
Well, what you're doing with probiotics, the analogy I'll use of probiotics is that you have a lawn, you have grass, good grass on it, right? And you also have weeds. And what you do with probiotics, you think of probiotics as good grass seed. So you come, you sprinkle the good grass seed on your lawn that has weeds. Eventually, if you do it long enough and often enough, the good grass seed outcompetes the weeds. So, and basically, that's what you're doing with probiotics. Now, as I always said to everybody, probiotics are not inherently what we call good bacteria. There's nothing good or bad about them, you know. And my standing joke is that they don't go to church on Sunday. They don't put extra money in the collection plate. But they're called good bacteria because the waste products they produce is beneficial to the body, or the waste products that they produce is also is tolerated by the body. But like anything else, you need to get a wide variety of good probiotics, not just one species, because if you just concentrate on one species of probiotic and that's the only thing you do, you might get too much of that one probiotic into your system. And then all of a sudden it stops being a good bacteria and it becomes a bad bacteria because it produces so much waste products that your body can't handle it. So that's why you should get a balanced approach with the use of probiotics.
Okay.
Now, after talking about all the probiotics, etc., I like to stress that one of the best ways of helping your gut is to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. Fruits and vegetables provides the body with good fiber, which can be used by the probiotics and the microbiome. It increases the ability of it to grow. Secondly, fruits and vegetables are a very good source of antioxidants, which is used to attack what we call free radicals or quench free radicals. And free radicals are one of the first things, because it's important in the pathway of disease production.
Excellent.
Does that make sense? I hope.
It certainly does. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Gordon Chang. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the treatment of myopia on The Tonic. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Dr. Fallon Patel is the owner of Fallon Vision Group, a multi-location optometry practice serving communities across the Greater Toronto area. A graduate of the University of Waterloo, Dr. Patel earned both her Bachelor of Science and Doctor of Optometry degrees with Dean's Honors in 2011. She holds a fellowship with the College of Vision Development and specializes in preventative pediatric eye care with a focus on advanced myopia control solutions, including orthokeratology and MySight, which is a registered trademark, one-day contact lenses. Dr. Patel leads a dedicated contact lens clinic for children and continues to integrate innovation, technology, and clinical excellence into everyday practice. Welcome to the show, Dr. Patel. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Doing well. So myopia is actually something we've never covered on the show, and I think it might be helpful if we start off by explaining what it is.
Okay, so myopia is also termed nearsightedness. And so why do we call it nearsighted? It's where your vision is very good up close, but you have difficulty seeing far away. And so it's essentially a condition where the eye grows too long from the front to the back, making it harder to see objects clearly at the distance.
And I understand that we're seeing a surge in cases among younger children today. Why is that?
Yeah, you know, so prior to, like, when I was in school, we were taught that this was mostly genetic, was the risk factor. But today, we know more, and we understand that it's not just genetics. So modern lifestyle factors, things like spending more time indoors, more time on increased near vision tasks, such as screens, can significantly impact your risk of myopia.
So is it that because people aren't using their vision for far away, they're losing the ability to lose their vision for seeing far away? Is that what's going on?
Well, yeah, we can't directly correlate it. So the studies are mostly just done, with associated risk factors. So we can't say why or how. We don't really know the mechanisms, to be honest. But we do know that there are risk factors such as being outdoors. We don't know whether it's sunshine, vitamin D, being able to see further away is more protective, and being up close and near tasks is worsening. There's a lot of theories, but we can at least conclude to those specific things, such as the screens and outdoor activity, being risk factors.
Got it. So I would imagine that early diagnosis and management of treatment of childhood myopia is pretty important, huh?
Yeah, you know, we take it for granted. And so, you know, the concern isn't just about blurry vision. Like in the past, a child's prescription would get stronger. We would treat it with glasses. Great, child can see. But what happens is that tends to get worse over time. And as the eye elongates, you don't notice it now, but later in life, you're at a much higher risk of increase for diseases. Things like diseases that are irreversible. We're talking vision loss. We're talking glaucoma, retinal detachment, things like myopic maculopathy. You know, these are very serious eye conditions, and they are hand in hand with an increased risk of myopia. And another thing I'm going to mention is like in practice right now, we're not seeing, you know, baby boomers. There isn't a high amount of high myopia in that population group. It's happening more kind of, you know, in our children today, in maybe the millennials, you know. So it hasn't really hit us yet as to what this may even look like in the future for people and their sight.
So I understand that the MiSight one-day contact lenses are the first and only FDA-approved soft lenses to actually slow myopia progression in kids. Can you explain how they work and what makes them different from regular vision correction options?
Yeah, so the MiSight one-day lenses, they really were a game changer when we introduced that into our practice, because not only does it correct your blurry distance vision, but it provides a solution for us to treat that myopia progression, meaning, you know, we're stopping the powers, we're slowing down the powers from getting worse, and we're also slowing the length of that eyeball growing. And so traditional glasses or contact lenses would simply help a child see clearly, but you know, they don't stop the eyes from continuing to grow and get worse, as I was mentioning. And so what MiSight lenses do, they have a dual focus technology, an optical design where part of the lens corrects the vision while the other part defocuses the peripheral part of the retina, which in a way signals the eyes to slow down its growth. And so this is the more proactive approach, and this is what sets MiSight apart.
Some parents might wonder about safety and ease of use. Are daily contact lenses like MiSight really suitable for kids, like, I don't know, preteens, etc.?
I know, we get that question asked all the time, and absolutely. So contact lenses are safe for children. You know, they're daily. These are daily disposable contact lenses that we're talking about. So they are ideal for children. They require no cleaning, no storage. You just put them in the morning, insert them in your eyes, and dispose them at night in the garbage. So kids as young as 8 can actually learn to handle them with ease on their own. And they work great with active lifestyle. So let's say if your child is into sports, play soccer, hockey, dances, cheerleading. Unlike glasses, these lenses stay on during all activities, providing continuous treatment throughout the day.
What's your experience in the clinic using the MiSight?
Okay, experience in the clinic. So there's a MiSight study. So the study, I'm just going to quote the statistics so you have a background.
Yeah.
It showed a 59% average reduction in progression in myopia over a 3-year period in children who wore the lenses versus those who didn't. So that's a huge, if you think about like a child might have -6 or you might be -6 as an adult.
Yeah.
If you had this intervention as a kid, you would have been 59%, you know, lower perhaps. So you might've been like less than a -3, which is substantial. If you're thinking about, you know, things like LASIK surgery down the road and candidacy for that, it is substantial. So in my practice, what I've seen actually, the results have been better than that. So I've seen children stabilize far earlier than expected, and often, you know, it reduces the need for stronger glasses prescriptions year after year. Absolutely. And it's been really just an incredibly rewarding space to be able to help these kids and the parents, because now we're increasing their confidence. They're able to stay active, do the things that they love. So, and me as an optometrist, I sleep well at night knowing that I've actually done something to help protect their future, future vision and reduce their health risks in the future.
So these lenses, are they the soft lenses or are they harder lenses?
So these lenses that we're speaking of are soft, daily disposable lenses. So they're one day lenses.
Gotcha. Okay. So those can be, I mean, both are kind of tricky to learn how to put in. Do you find, like, do you have to teach the kids how to put them in? Like, how quickly can they absorb that information?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, you know what? Kids are a lot smarter than you think. And they actually absorb the information really, really well. So they pick up on it very easily. We have contact lens fitters that help them, you know, every step of the way. And we do teach them how to insert and safely remove them before they go home. Because if you, once you teach the child how to do it, you know, everything goes up. Compliance goes up. It's easier. The child's more confident in handling that. And so you'd be surprised. They learn quick. They learn a lot more quickly than we think that they would. We just have to, you know, let them try.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be heading back to school within a few weeks, and August is Children's Eye Health Month. What message would you like to share with parents about protecting their kids' vision in the long term?
Yeah. So my biggest message to parents is do not wait. So school screenings aren't enough. So sometimes there are school screenings that are done in the classroom in school, but these are not enough. So I would highly encourage you to book a comprehensive eye exam with an optometrist before the school year starts. Like right now, we're heading right into season. I would recommend to start right now. And if your child is already nearsighted, to ask your optometrist about myopia management options and the MySight lenses and what it can do for your child. So just think of it as early action makes all the difference in protecting your child's vision, not just for today, but for later in life.
Well, I appreciate your advice. And in fact, Cooper Vision Canada is giving the listeners a chance to enter to win a pair of tickets to the Ontario Science Centre exhibits at Sherway Gardens. You can also visit the Cooper Vision Elementary Classroom pop-up at Sherway Gardens on Friday, August 22 and Saturday, August 23, where parents and guardians can learn about nearsightedness in children and treatment options such as MySight One Day contact lenses. To enter, post the giveaway on Instagram and mention the Tonic and Cooper Vision. Share this post on your Instagram story and tag at Tonic and at Cooper Vision Canada to qualify. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Fallon Patel. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss eating lighter in the summer on The Tonic.
I'd like to give a shout out to our longstanding sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Shauna Lindzen is a dietitian and nutritionist. She is a program developer and nutrition leader at Wellspring Cancer Center Support Network and enjoys seeing clients virtually and doing corporate wellness lectures. She runs practical cooking demonstrations that combine scientific knowledge with culinary education. Her demonstrations are unique, informative, delicious, and a lot of fun. And you can find a list of her nutrition classes and recipes at shaunalindzen.com. Welcome back to the show, Shauna. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jamie. Thanks for having me back.
So we're entering into the time of year, which is my favorite, summer Jamie, because you know, I'm outside all the time walking the dog and I'm active, but for some reason, at the end of the summer, not June, but towards the second half of the summer. That's when like I can wear the clothes where like I just look better and I feel better. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that I just don't eat as much and I don't eat as heavy in the summer. Do you see that? Is that your MO, or do you see that with the people that you work with?
Yes, Jamie. So when it's warm outside, our bodies are already feeling hot. So our appetite inherently goes down and our bodies are working harder to regulate the temperature, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel less hungry, right? Like I just don't need as much food.
It's interesting because in the cold weather, we're almost like hibernating. Our bodies want to warm up, so we eat more. So I get it. Most people do feel that way.
I always thought like our bodies, I know it's easier to like our bodies prepare for the winter. Like by the end of the summer, you start putting on weight and, you know, the fat collects to protect from the cold. But do we metabolize differently in the heat? Like, is that what's going on?
A little bit. Like if you think about digesting food, it produces heat just by the very act of digesting food. So in a way, our metabolism does change according to how much food we eat. So we will require less calories if we're active and eating less. We're going to feel really hot. But if you think about it, if you're bike riding outside or you're hiking, you're almost suppressing your appetite, but your energy requirements go up. And you will lose a few pounds in the summer. But with that being said, there's more parties and you're going to beaches, you're going to cottages, and you're probably consuming more food in that way.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot going on in the summer, more exercise outside, but potentially eating more as well.
I also think it's easier to eat healthy during the summer because, and in particularly when we're not, you know, when we're avoiding food that's coming in from the U.S. and eating local, like, it's easier to eat the fruits and vegetables in Canada in the summer. It just is, right?
It is. And in terms of eating, we think more of summer salads, like
right.
A fresh green salad with some protein on it, or a bean salad with some vegetables in it, as opposed to heavy carbohydrate ridden meals, like let's say mac and cheese, like the hot meals that are comfort foods. So I totally agree. We tend to get more of the seasonal produce. And that's a very good point about making sure you're buying Canadian and supporting the local farmers, as well as producing your own food in your backyard.
So I guess we do innately eat differently, but should we? I mean, other than drinking more water and making sure we're hydrated, is it important to eat differently in the heat?
Not necessarily in terms of nutrients, but in terms of getting more of the produce in, it is a good idea. Because when you do sweat, you obviously need, if it's really hot out, you obviously need more hydration. So people tend to go to their local coffee shop and get like iced drinks, that type of thing. So as a dietitian, I typically say, try not to have the drinks that are really high in sugar, right? Those iced coffees with a few flavor shots, and make your own smoothies for, your water bottle. You could put in, you can press your own juice, even in like a high power blender, you could make like a watermelon, strawberry, basil drink, that type of thing. So you want to make sure that you are choosing lots of vitamins and minerals to rehydrate, those being electrolytes, so sodium, potassium, magnesium, especially if you are a heavy exerciser.
Yep.
You want to make sure that you're hydrating and getting your vitamins and minerals as well as your fluid.
Okay, so we kind of have a working rule in our house because we have a small kitchen. It's an older house. We try not to use the oven in the summer because it just heats up the entire house. And so that kind of edifies what type of food we're eating. Maybe we're using the barbecue more because it's outdoors, but it's also a question of eating, more al fresco and eating cold preparations as opposed to like stews and sauces and roasts that you would cook in the oven. So do you have any recipes along that line?
Absolutely. So my main suggestion and go-to are grilled vegetables. You could marinate vegetables a few days in advance, put them in a bowl or a bag, and just throw them on the barbecue. And especially meatier vegetables like portobello mushrooms, grilled peppers are delicious. And you can make a charcuterie board. And as you say, just have kind of a meal that is put together, but not like casserole-like. So delicious meals could be made with different cheese, crackers, grilled vegetables, dips, olives. You could do such a healthy charcuterie board. Lots of people these days are doing that instead of having the heavier meals.
Okay, so I'm going to go a little bit contra on you there. When you're talking about, I'm the grill master in the house, and somebody gave me advice once, and I followed it, and it actually makes for better grilled vegetables. I actually do not marinate the vegetables in advance. I make a vinaigrette, and I put them in the vinaigrette after I've grilled the vegetables. It makes for more even cooking, and you don't have the flare-ups, because sometimes there's like sweeteners in the marinades, which tend to char the vegetables in ways that you may not want. So it's just a tip, I would say.
It's funny you say that, because my go-to is typically olive oil, balsamic vinegar, salt and pepper.
Yeah.
And literally that's all I do at the beginning. And then if I'm doing something like a romesco sauce, would be like grilled peppers with some garlic and some fresh herbs, pureed, and then I would put that on after. So sometimes I do both, but I do go more on the simple side with an acid and an oil. So the balsamic vinegar, I find, grills it, gives it that sweetness and that char without, too much, adding too much to it. So I usually don't add like honey or sugar. If I put, I will put that into a sauce after the fact. So we are on the same page there.
Okay. Yeah, cool. A lot of people use store-bought marinades and they tend to have higher sugar content. And even with grilled meats, I will tend to not put a ton of stuff on it. And certainly I'm mindful of the sugars. The other thing I was going to say, if in addition to doing a charcuterie board, is to do like a grain bowl, like get farro or barley and mix it with grilled vegetables, maybe some feta cheese, and then a vinaigrette.
What I love about that idea is that you could do the grains in advance and freeze the grains. So you can do farro, you can do quinoa, you can do wild rice, and put them in, cook them up. Most people don't know that you can do this. Cook them up, put them in pre-portioned like containers or baggies, let's say a cup per person of the grain. And then you always have that grain and you don't have to, as you say, turn on the stovetop. You could just go outside, barbecue up the vegetables, barbecue up the protein, and you always have that grain already done. So it's batch cooking for the grain.
Yeah. We're a bit of maniacs at our house. We do have these types of foods a lot. So like we'll have quinoa. I'm not a huge quinoa fan, but like farro and the rice, we have containers of it on the go. We'll have confit garlic. We'll have like pickled red onion. And so putting together these bowls is actually pretty quick, right? Like if you have that, just adding some beans and stuff or even, cook some tofu up as protein, like you're good to go. And it's a quick meal.
Yeah, you're talking my language here. I love it. And the different bowls, if you have all of those sides and condiments all ready to go, you will always have a healthy lunch, a healthy dinner, and it won't take a lot of effort because you have it all prepped in advance.
Yeah. We've been every year the garden grows differently. For whatever reason, last year the kale didn't do so well and the chard did. Now, for some reason, it's flippy floppy. Our kale is doing amazing this summer. In fact, we've harvested twice already and it's still growing.
My kale hasn't been doing so well. It's still kind of sitting at the beginning, like it hasn't flourished yet.
Yeah, no, the thing about the leafy greens is they need less light than you think. They actually do better in the shade. Did you know that?
Oh, really? happy. Oh, then mine should be flourishing.
I need to come by. I need to come by and check out what you got going on. So one quick question. So do you have any, like, do you have any new ideas for the use of kale? We did a kale and Borlotti bean pasta the other night, but what else would you do with kale?
It's funny, with kale, I do like it slightly wilted. So just literally as you probably did with your pasta, not sauteing it until it's like very limp.
Yeah.
Just slightly warmed up, I think is a really good way to go with the kale. And I know kale chips were kind of, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But they're delicious. Like my kids can eat those, you know, can eat a whole head of kale. I just want to say my trick with a kale chip is putting the oven on low, which is good because you don't want to heat the house up. So like really low, 225, and yep, roasting the kale off for about half an hour instead of putting the oven on high, like 425 for 10 to 15 minutes. I find that it isn't as bitter when you do that, and just, you know, rubbing it with some olive oil, yep, beforehand and putting a little salt. And that's the way I like kale. It's crispy, it's light, it doesn't taste very bitter if you roast it at low heat.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy summer, Jamie.
You as well. That was Shauna Lindzen. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to identify emotional triggers on The Tonic. Cataracts are the leading cause of vision loss in adults over 50. But the good news is they're highly treatable. At Oakville Laser Eye Center, patients receive advanced laser cataract surgery with personalized surgeon-led care. Using cutting-edge technology and customized treatment plans, their expert team helps patients see clearly again to help them rediscover life's details. Book your consultation today at www.oakvillelaser.ca or call 905-337-3736. For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Aran Magen earned his MA in education and PhD in psychology from Stanford University, completed postdoctoral training in child psychology and population health, and currently serves as an assistant clinical professor at the Yale School of Medicine Department of Psychiatry. He's the founder of ParentingForHumans.com and DivorcingDads.org, which support parents in creating strong, collaborative, and joyful relationships with their children. He's also the founder of Early Alert, which prevents suicide among students and veterans. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I'm doing well.
So not to upset you, but we're here to talk about emotional triggers today. So
the opposite of upsetting. I love talking about emotional triggers.
Okay. Well, you never know, right? You never know what's going to trigger somebody. But maybe after this interview, we'll learn about what might be triggering people and what to do about it. So how would you define an emotional trigger?
An emotional trigger is something that makes us immediately go into danger mode. And however we deal with danger is however we'll deal with that trigger. It's like a shortcut, a button to the part of us that says, this is very dangerous.
And you're not talking about physical threats, right? You're probably talking about something somebody has said or the way somebody's expressing themselves, the tone they're using. Is that what we're talking about when we talk about emotional triggers, or am I off base there?
You know, it could be any of those things. I think it's just much easier to understand and consider totally normal when something physically threatening happens and we respond as if there's a great danger, because there obviously is. But it's more confusing and surprising to see people reacting as if there's great danger to something that we don't perceive as danger, but for them may feel very dangerous. And that's usually because of an emotional experience that they're having as a result of that trigger.
So it's a very subjective thing, right?
I mean, something that might be very triggering for me may be totally benign for you and vice versa.
Okay. Where do emotional triggers come from?
Typically past experiences, something that happened, either a specific event or a pattern of events that we've experienced in the past. So for example, if we were really little kids and our parents would always speak in a very soft and kind tone just before exploding and making our lives very miserable for a long time, that might make me become very nervous when people use that particular kind of tone. Or if I've been through an event where I've been accused of acting in a certain way, and as a result, I suffered really bad repercussions, then the next time somebody accuses me of that thing, that can be incredibly activating, incredibly triggering for me. So usually past experiences.
How can somebody tell if they become emotionally triggered? Like I am notorious for having a short fuse. I know it's going to set me off, and I know when I've been set off. It's pretty obvious, but it isn't necessarily obvious for everybody what's happening, is it?
Yeah, I think a big part of what's so challenging about getting triggered is that one of the main features of becoming emotionally triggered is that we stop self-monitoring, we stop self-critiquing, and we just think we're right. We're 100% right during the time that we're super activated. And that's such a difficult feature of being in that emotional state because we can't stop and check ourselves. So there are a few key moments during which we can regain consciousness, if you will, and realize that we're either already triggered or well on our way to being triggered. So one is when we notice ourselves doing the thing that is very obviously out of proportion to whatever's happening. We might find out only an hour after the fact, right? Somebody said something little, we exploded at them, or we totally shut down and ran away. And we might realize it's just an hour later, a day later, whatever it is. So that's one way to discover that we've been triggered so much. Another is in the moment. We might realize, oh, I am like really behaving totally out of proportion to what's happening here. So catching it in the moment as it's happening. And then if we have great fortune to have developed the awareness to do this early enough, we might catch ourselves as we're ramping up and realizing, oh, I'm responding. I feel like this is super dangerous. And actually, the situation is pretty benign. And these are different times during that. I'm gesticulating wildly with my hands. You can't quite see the graphs that I'm painting in the air. But these are different times during that on ramp to the triggered reaction that we can catch ourselves on our way up, as we're up there, and then well after the fact. And in each of those cases, there are things that we can do to repair or go back on track.
I suppose if you understood what your triggers were, right, like from past experience, right, like if you actually learn from past experience, you might recognize the types of things that set you off. Like I know what sets me off. I choose whether I want to lean into it or not, right? But like, so even to use your example, if somebody is using that quiet speak, right? Like if that's happening, then you should be aware that you might get triggered, right?
Maybe, but a very important feature of being triggered is we sort of lose consciousness. We just get sucked into that experience that's playing in our head and we have a hard time paying attention to what's around us. So there are two things that we can be aware of. One is the thing that's happening that could be triggering for us, somebody using a particular tone of voice, somebody using a specific word, the kind of noises that are around us, things like that. We might be aware that this is happening. And as you said, lean in or lean away or try to create some sort of mental space. And the other is recognizing your own reaction. And I think that's actually the more reliable cue. Because typically something will happen that maybe passes a little bit under our awareness and suddenly we're very activated. And if we learn to recognize that state in ourselves, saying, oh, I am about to make a very drastic statement regarding this relationship or this situation, or I'm about to make a very big decision and I actually only thought about it for 3 seconds, or I'm sweating and my heart is pounding or my stomach is suddenly hurting. Recognizing these signals is a big hint that it's time to slow way, way down and not do anything that might be hard to recover from.
Is it possible to see when other people have been triggered? Because I presume their behaviors may be different than the way we would be acting if we were triggered.
Yeah, that's a really important point that you make, right? Because we don't have access to their internal experience, but we might have a few other hints that we can use. So one is, do they look physically stressed, right? Are they panting? Are their eyes really wide? Are they sweating or starting to shake as they talk? Things like that. That's one. Or do they look like they're disassociating? Do they look like they're shut down or withdrawn, like quite suddenly, you know, not making eye contact, speaking much more quietly than usual, acting like there's an active threat around them? So these are all kind of observable cues. And then there's also the content. If they're saying something pretty extreme, this might be because they're thinking in a way that's really extreme right now, because they're feeling so threatened. And so to see this, if somebody's making a big leap, an important statement, again, a drastic statement, starting things, ending things, changing things, those are all signs that they may not be thinking totally clearly right in that moment.
What should I do if I realize that I've been triggered?
The biggest thing is to take some space to calm down and disconnect. Sometimes we can, in the moment, calm ourselves down and re-engage in a thoughtful way. Sometimes it's impossible. And the best thing to do is just to actually take a break and come back to it or to the person, to the situation a little bit later. But as soon as I realize it, I am very activated, that I'm like about to fly out of my skin, close my eyes, take a breath, take another breath if I need to, maybe tell the other person, you know what, I need a little break. Okay, I'm going to be back in a minute. Go wash my face, come back. If that didn't work, to say, you know, maybe this is better to continue later on. This is really activating for me. And I don't think I'm in a productive place to be having this conversation. So creating space is the biggest thing, if at all possible.
And what if we notice or we believe that somebody else has been triggered? What can we do?
We can do a couple of things. One is to just share the observation, meaning literally what we see, not our interpretation. Not to say, I think you've been really triggered, because that can come across really poorly, but to say, you know, you look like you're really upset right now, which may have the other person responding by saying something like, yeah, I'm really upset. You just said that, blah, blah, blah. And then it's an opportunity to fix, to correct, to restate, to whatever it is, right? So just saying, you seem really upset, or to say like, I just noticed that you totally shut down. What happened? Something like that. Just bring awareness back to the moment and to the interactions. That's one thing to do. Another thing that we could do is to suggest a break, to say, you know, this is kind of a big thing that we're talking about, or, you know, this seems to be like really hard. Would it be good to take a little break from talking about this, or something like that? And then if none of these things work, it's also okay to even just hold it in our mind that maybe this person doesn't really fully mean everything that they're doing or saying right now. And so to allow ourselves to hold a little bit of doubt, so we can come back to the interaction later on, once everybody's cooled off, and say, I just want to check that you're still feeling this way about whatever it is, right? Then an hour later, a day later, whenever is the right time to reconnect with that person, and just check again. Because, you know, you said that you want to do this thing, you want to spend all of our money on this thing, you want to never see each other again, you want to whatever it is. And I just, because you seemed really upset at the time, and I want to see, you know, if you've had any more thoughts since then. So just to hold like a little bit of space, a little bit of grace in our head, and allow the possibility that the person in front of us is just acting out of very strong emotion fueled by the sense of danger, rather than assuming that everything that they're saying was intentional and thoughtful and considered.
Not to be judgmental, but I believe that some people are more easily triggered than others. In other words, it's innate to them, whatever fragilities they may have, whatever experiences they may have. What do you think the obligation is if you see somebody you're interacting with who's being triggered? How much of it is their responsibility and how much of it is yours? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question. I think that we take as much responsibility as we want to and as we're comfortable doing. And if we have a relationship with someone who's very dear to us, and they tend to get triggered very frequently by things that happen, or maybe by things that we do, even though we do them benignly, then it's really an important decision to make, ideally jointly, but sometimes there's not the option to make it jointly. It's really an important decision to make. How much am I going to adapt to this person's sensitivities? and how much am I going to expect the other person to adapt to my normal behavior? And vice versa, if I'm triggered a lot by something that somebody else does, right? Does this make sense? Are we going to work to make this sustainable so that we can communicate and we can interact and we can spend time together? Or at some point, do we say, look, this is just too incompatible. It's too much work for both of us to try to either reduce one person's sensitivity or increase the other person's considerateness at the price of them not feeling like they're able to behave naturally. I don't think that there's an obvious answer here. This is really the question of compatibility and sustainability and how much work are we willing to put into taking care of the relationship and taking care of the other person.
I'd like for you to come back again, and I'd like to explore this notion of emotional triggers in a broader context, because this conversation has been about, you know, one-on-one relationships. But I think triggering occurs like in different circumstances, like in media or in education, et cetera. And I, you know, as a professor, I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on that. Well, can we do that?
Yeah, I would love to.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Gordon Chang, Dr. Falon Patel, Shauna Lindzen, and Ran McGann. Thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.